platoon comm officers like Raglan and McCann, and its limited range was stunted further by the depth of the rock they were under. But there was a signal, intermittent and on a repeating automatic vox burst. The identifier was Tanith, and the platoon series code that of the 7th. Blaine's men.
"What is it, Cuff?"
Larkin asked, his eyes sharp.
"Trooper Caffran?"
Major Rawn questioned. Caffran pushed past them both and hurried up the tunnel to where Gaunt stood with the Imperial tactician. As he approached, he saw Wayland gazing at the lit displays of Gaunt's data slate, his eyes wide.
"This is unbelievable,"
Ferret breathed.
"Everything we hoped for."
Gaunt shot a sharp glance at him. "Hoped for?"
"You know what I mean, Bram. Thrown. That something like this could still exist. That it could be so close. We were right to chase this without hesitation. Dravir cannot be allowed to gain control of this."
Ferret paused, reviewing the data again, and looked back at the Commissar.
"This makes all the work, all the loss, all the effort worthwhile. To know there really was a prize here worth fighting for. This proves we're not wasting our time or jumping at ghosts, no offense to the present company."
He said this with a diplomatic smile at Caffran as the trooper edged up closer. Watching the tactical officer, McColl stiffened.
Was it the Fething place again, screwing with his mind? Or was there something about this grand Imperial tactician that even Gaunt hadn't noticed?
"Caffran," Gaunt said, turning to his make-do vox officer. Caffran handed him the foil from the field caster that he had just printed out.
"A signal from Sergeant Blaine, sir. Very indistinct, very chopped. Took me a while to get it. It says Ghostmaker, sir."
Gaunt screwed his eyes shut for a moment.
"Bram?"
"It's nothing, Ferret," Gaunt said to his old friend. "Just what I was expecting and hoped wouldn't come to pass. Dravir is making his countermove."
Gaunt turned to Caffran.
"Can we get a signal out?"
he asked, nodding to the Voxer on its canvas sling over Caffran's shoulder.
"We can try Fithin hard and repeatedly," responded Caffran,
and Gaunt and McColl both grinned. Caffran had borrowed the line from comms officer Raglan, who had always used that retort when the channels were particularly bad. Gaunt handed Caffran a pre-prepared message foil. A glance showed Caffran it wasn't in Tanith battle tongue or Imperial Guard central cipher either. He couldn't read it, but he knew it was coded in Vitrian combat cant. Caffran fed the foil into the vox set, let the machine read it and assemble it, and then flicked the send switch, marked by a glowing rune at the edge of the set's compact fascia.
"It's gone. Repeat every 3 minutes, Caffran, and watch for an acknowledgement."
Gaunt turned back to Ferret. He took the data slate map back from him smartly.
"We advance," he told the Imperial tactician. "Tell your men," he nodded at the Crusade troopers, "to follow every instruction my scout gives, without question."
With McColl in the front, the raiding party moved on.
A long way behind, back down the team, Major Rawn shuddered. The image of the monster Haldane had just flickered across his mind again. He felt the seeping blackness of Haldane's touch and felt his surly consciousness wince.
"Get out," his thoughts shrilled in his head.
"Get out!"
16. It was, Sergeant Blaine decided, ironic. The defense was as epic as any hallowed story of the Guard. 50 men, gainsaying the massed assault of almost 1,000. But no one would ever know. This story, of Guard against Guard, was too unpalatable for stories. The greatest act of the Tanith First and Only would be a record hushed up and unspoken of, even by high command. The Janteen units, supported by light artillery and heavy weapons in the valley depths, swung up around the rise Blaine's men commanded in a double curl, like the arms of a throat talk, extending overlapping fans of lasfire in disciplined double-burst shots. The rain of shots, nearly 1,500 every 20 seconds, spat over the ghosts' heads or thumped into the sloping soil, puffing up clods of smoky dust and igniting numerous brush fires through the cloaking bracken. Sergeant Blaine watched them from cover through his scope, his flesh prickling as he saw the horribly assured way they covered the ground and made advance. The warrior caste of Jant were heavy troops, their silver and purple combat armor made for assault, rather than speed or stealth. They were stormtroopers, not skirmishers. The Tanith were the light, agile, stealthy ones. But for all that, the drilled brilliance of the Janteen was frightening. They used every ounce of skill and every stitch of cover to bring the long claw of their attack up and around to throttle the Ghost's 7th platoon. Blaine had fought the temptation to return fire when the Janteen first addressed them. They had nothing to match the range of the Janteen heavy weapons, and Blaine told himself that the last fire fusillade was as much a psychological threat as anything. His 50 men were deployed along the ridgeline in a straggled stitch of natural foxholes that the Ghosts had augmented with entrenching tools and sacking made of stealth cloaks and sleeping rolls, lashed into bags and filled with dust and soil. Blaine made his command instructions clear. Fix blades, set weapons to single shot, hold fire, and wait for his signal. For the first 10 minutes, their line was silent as lasfire crackled up at them, and the air sifted with white smoke plumes and drifting dust. Light-caliber field shells fluttered down, along with a few rocket-propelled grenades, most falling way short and creating new foxholes on the slope. Blaine first thought they were aiming astray until he saw the pattern. The field guns were digging cover holes and craters in the flank of the hillside for the Janteen infantry to advance into. Already, to his west, Janteen squads had crossed from their advance and dug into a line of fresh shell holes 100 meters short of the Ghost's line. Immediately, the field guns adjusted their range and began digging the next line for advance. Blaine cursed the Janteen perfection. Commissar Gaunt had always said there were two foes most to be feared, the utterly feral and the utterly intelligent, and of the pair, the second were the worst. The Janteen were schooled and educated men who excelled at the intricacies of war. They were justly feared. Blaine had, in fact, heard stories of the Janteen patricians even before he had entered the guard. He could hear them singing now, the long, languid, low hymn of victory, harmonized by nearly 1,000 rich male voices, beautiful, oppressive, demoralizing. He shuddered. "That damn singing," Trooper Kaline hissed beside him. Blaine agreed, but said nothing. The first las rounds were now crossing overhead, and if the Janteen guns were reaching them, it meant one reassuring fact. The Janteen were in range. Blaine tapped his microbead link, selecting the open command channel. He spoke in Tanith battle cant.
"Select targets carefully. Not a wasted shot now. Fire at will."
The Ghosts opened fire. Streams of single-shot cover fire whipped down from their hidden positions into the advancing fans of the Janteen. In the first salvo alone, Blaine saw 10 or more of the Janteen jerk and fall. Their rate of fire increased. The wave punctured the Janteen ranks in 3 dozen places and made the incoming rain of fire hesitate and stutter. The infantry duel began, 2 lines of dug-in troopers answering each other volley for volley up and down a steeply angled and thickly covered slope. The very air became warm and electric dry with the ozone stench of lasfire. It was evenly pitched, with the Tanith enjoying the greater angle of coverage and the greater protection the hill afforded. But, unlike the Janteen, they were not resupplied every minute by lines of reinforcement. Even firing off a well-placed round every 6 seconds and scoring a kill 1 out of 4 shots, Blaine felt they were helpless. They could not retreat, neither could they advance in a charge to use the ground to their advantage. Defeat one way, overwhelming death the other. The Ghosts could do nothing but hold their line and fight to the last. The Janteen had more options, but the one they decided to use amazed Blaine. After a full 30 minutes of fire exchange, the patricians charged. En masse. Close on 1,000 heavy troopers, bayonets fixed to muzzle clips, rose as one from the bracken-choked foxholes and stormed up the slope towards his platoon. It was an astonishing decision. Blaine gasped, and his first thought was that madness had gripped the Janteen command. A sort of madness had, but one that would surely win the day. The 50 guns of the Ghosts had more targets than they could pick. Dozens, hundreds of Janteen never made it up the slope, their twitching, thrashing, or limp bodies collapsing brokenly into the ochre undergrowth. But there was no way Blaine's men could cut them all down before they reached the hill line.
"Blood of the Emperor,"
spat Blaine as he understood the tactic. Superior numbers, total loyalty, and an unquenchable thirst for victory. The Janteen commander had deployed his troops as expendable, using their sheer weight to soak up the ghosts' fire and overwhelm them. 300 Janteen patricians were dead before the charge made it into Tanith lines. Dead to the Tanith guns, the slope of the hill, the angles of death. But that still left close on 700 of them to meet head-on in screaming waves at the ditch line of the slit trenches. Singing the ancient war hymn of Jant Normanidus, the Alto Credo, Major Brockus led the assault over the Tanith ghost's paltry defense line. A lasround punched through his cloth-armored sleeve and scorched the flesh of one arm. He swung around, double-blasting the ghost before him as teams of his soldiery came in behind him. The ghosts were nothing, and to tear into them like this was a joy that exorcised Brockus's own ghosts, ghosts which had been with him one way or another since the humiliation on Ked, and which had been further reinforced on Fortis Binary and Pyrites. Anger, battle joy, lust, rage, they thrilled through the powerful body of the Janteen patrician. The tempered steel of his bayonet slashed left and right, impaling and killing. Twice he had to fire his rifle point blank to loosen a corpse stuck on his blade. The nobility of his upbringing made him recognize the courage and fighting skill of the spidery black-clad men they crushed in this trench. They fought to the last, and with great skill, but they were light troops, dressed in thin fabrics, utterly unmatching the physical strength and resilience of his hard-armored Janteen. His men had the discipline of the military academies of Jant in their blood, the fierce will to win. That was what made them patricians, what made them as feared by others of the Imperial Guard as the guards feared the Adeptus Astartes. If Brockus thought of the cost, which had earned them the route to the top of the hill, it was only in terms of the victory hymns they would sing at the mass funerals. If it cost 1 or 1,000, victory was still victory, and a punishment victory over traitor scum like this was the most cherished of all. The ghosts were vermin to be exterminated. Colonel Flens had been right to give the order to charge, even though he had seemed strangely pale and horrified when he had given it. Victory was theirs. Sergeant Blaine caught the first Janteen over the lip of the ditch, in the belly with his bayonet, and threw him over his head as he rolled. The man screamed as he died. A second bayoneted Blaine's left thigh as he followed in, and the sergeant bellowed in pain, swinging his lasgun so that the blade cut open the man's throat under the armor of the helmet. Then Blaine fired a single shot point-blank into the writhing man's face. Colline shot 2 Janteen on the lip of the line and then fell under a hammer blow of fixed blades. Fighting was now thick, face-to-face, close quarter. Simba shot 3 of Colline's killers before a loose lash shot took the top of his head off and dropped his twitching body into a narrow ditch already blocked by a dozen dead. Killing another Janteen with a combination of bayonet thrust and rifle butt swipe, Blaine saw the Voxcaster spin from Simba's dying grasp and wished he had the time to grab it and send a signal to Gaunt or Korbeck. But the top of the ridge was a seething mass of men, stabbing, striking, firing, dying, and there was no pace to give and no moment to spare. This was the heat of battle, white heat, hate heat, as it is often spoken of by soldiers, but seldom seen. Blaine shot another patrician dead through the chest at a range of 2 meters and then swung his blade around into the chin of another that lunged at him. Something hot and hard nudged him from behind. He looked down and saw the point of a Janteen bayonet pushing out through his chest, blood gouting around its steel sheen. Snarling with glee, Major Brockus fired his lasgun and let the shot blow the stumbling ghost off his blade. Sergeant Blaine fell on his face without a murmur. 17. It was as hot as Milo had ever known it. The main column of the ghosts was slowly advancing through the tumbled stones of the necropolis, and had emerged into a long valley of ancient colonnades, which rose on either hand in sun-blocking shadows. The valley, a natural rift in the mountain on either side of which the primitive architects had built towering formations of alcoves, was nearly 8 kilometers long, and its floor, 0.5 kilometer wide, was treacherous with the slumped stonework and rockfalls cast down from the high structures by slow time. The energetic feedback of the defense grid had exploded ruinously in here as well, and the fallen rocks, tarry black and primeval, had soaked it up and were now radiating it out again. It was past 60 degrees down here, and dry hot. Sweat streaked every Tanith man as he crept forward. Their black fatigues were heavy with damp, and none, except the scouts, still wore cloaks. Trooper Desta, advancing alongside Milo, hawked and spat at the gritty black flank of a nearby slab and tutted as his spittle fizzled and fried into evaporated nothingness. Milo looked up. The gash of sky above the rift sides was pale and blue and bespoke a fair summer's day. Down here, the long shadows and rocky depth suggested a cool shelter. But the heat was overwhelming, worse than the jungle miasma of the tropical calderas on Caligula. Worse than the humid reaches of Voltis, worse than anything he had ever known, even the parching hot season of high summer at Tanith Magna. The radiating rocks glowed in his mind, aching their way into his drying bones and sinuses. He longed for moisture. He teased himself with memories of pyrites, where the stabbing wet cold of the outer city reaches had seemed so painful. Would he were there now. He took out his water flask and sucked down a long slug of stale, blood-warm water. A half-shadow fell across him. Colonel Corbeck stayed his hand.
"Not so fast. We need to ration in this heat, and if you take it down too fast, you'll cramp and vomit, and sweat it out all the faster."
Milo nodded, clasping his bottle. He could see how pale and drawn Corbeck had become, his flesh pallid and wet in the deep shadows of the rift's belly. But there was more. More than the others were suffering. Pain.
"You're wounded, aren't you, sir?"
Corbeck glanced at Milo and shook his head.
"I'm fine. I'm bluff, lad."
"Yes.
Fine and bluff,"
Corbeck laughed, but there was no strength in his voice. Milo clearly saw the puncture rip in the side of Corbeck's tunic, which the colonel tried to hide. Black fabric showed little, but Milo was sure that the wet patches on Corbeck's fatigues were not sweat, unlike the patches on the other men. A cry came back down the rift from the scout units, and a moment later, something creaked on the wind. Corbeck howled an order, and the ghosts fanned out between the sweltering rock, rock that afforded them cover, but which they dare not touch. The enemy was counterattacking. They came at them down the valley, some on foot, most in the air. Dozens of small missile-shaped airships, garish and fiercely bright in color, and adorned with the grotesque symbols of chaos, powered down the rift towards them, propellers thumping in their diesel-smoking nacelles, their belly-slung baskets, gondolas, and platforms filled with armed warriors of chaos. The swarm of airships drifted down across the ghosts, raking the ground with fire. Now, it was all or nothing. 18. Dravir, his face angry and hollow-eyed, pushed aside the medics in the isolation sphere and yanked apart the plastic drapes veiling Inquisitor Haldane's cot. The Inquisitor gazed up at him with fathomlessly calm eyes from beneath the clamped medical support devices covering him.
"Hector!"
Dravir flung a data slate on the cot. The Inquisitor's one good hand carefully put down the small mirror he had been holding and took up the slate, keying the data flow with his long-nailed thumb.
"Madness!" Dravir spat. "The Janteen have taken the rise and exterminated Gaunt's rearguard, but Flens reports that the main Tanith unit has actually advanced into target Primaris. What, by the throne, do we do now? We're losing more men to our own than to the foe, and I still require victory here. I'll not face Makaroth for this."
Haldane studied the slate's information.
"Other regiments are moving in. The Mordian here, the Vitrians, they're close too. Let Gaunt's ghosts lead the assault on the Tight as they have begun. Sacrifice them to open a wedge. Move the patricians in behind to consolidate this and finish off the ghosts. Your main forces should be ready to advance after them by then."
Dravir took a deep breath. Tactically, the advice was sound. There was still a good opportunity to silence the ghosts without witnesses and still effect a victory.
"What of Gaunt?"
Haldane took up his mirror again and gazed into it.
"He progresses well. My pawn is still at his side, primed to strike when I command it. patience, Hector. We play games within games, and are all subservient to the intricate processes of war.
He fell silent, resolving images in the distances of the mirror invisible to the Lord General. Drevere turned away. The Inquisitor was still useful to him, but as soon as that usefulness ended, he would not hesitate to remove him. Gazing into the mirror, Haldane absently recognized the malicious thought in Drevere's blunt intellect. Drevere utterly misunderstood his place in the drama. He thought himself a leader, a manipulator, a commander. But in truth, he was nothing more than another pawn, and just as expendable. 19. Colonel Flens led the Jantine patricians down the great outer ditch and into the outskirts of the necropolis ruins, passing through the exploded steatite fragments and blackened corpses left by Korbeck's assault. Distantly, through the archways and stone channels, they could hear gunfire. The ghosts had plainly met more opposition inside. The afternoon was lengthening, the paling sky striated with lingering bands of smoke from the fighting. Flens had 612 men left, 40 of that number so seriously injured they had been retreated to the field hospitals far back at the deployment fields. 50 Tanith, fighting to the last, had taken over a third of his regiment. He felt bitterness so great that it all but consumed him. His hatred of Ibram Gaunt and the rivalry with the Tanith First that it had bred had been a burning frustration. Now, when they actually had the chance to face them on the field, the Tanith skirmishers had fought above their weight and scored a huge victory, even in defeat. He cared little now what happened. The other ghosts could live or die. All he wanted was one thing. Gaunt. He sent a magenta-level communicator to Drevere, expressing his simple wish. The reply surprised and delighted him. Drevere instructed Flens to place his main force under Brockus's direct command to continue the advance into the target Primaris. The battle orders were to neutralize the ghosts and then prosecute a direct assault on the enemy itself. With luck, the Tanith would be crushed between the Jantine and the forces of Chaos. But for Flens, there was a separate order. Drevere had learned from the Inquisitor Haldane that Gaunt was personally leading an insertion team into the city from below. The entry point, a shaft beneath an outcrop of stones on the hillside, was identified and a route outlined. On Drevere's personal orders, Flens was to lead a fire team in after the Commissar and destroy him. Flens quietly conveyed the directive to Brockus as they stood watching the men advance in three file lines up into the vast ancient necropolis. Brockus was swollen with pride at this command opportunity. The big man turned to face his colonel with a battle light firing his eyes. He drew off his glove and held out his hand to Flens. The colonel removed his own gauntlet and they shook, the thumb-clasping grip of brotherhood learned in the honor schools of Jant Normanidus.
"Advance with hope. Fight with luck. Win with honor, Brockus," Flens said. "Sheath your blade well, colonel," his second replied.
Flens turned, pulling his glove back on and tapping his micro-bead.
"Troopers Herrick, Stigand, Anjou, Avranche, and Ebzan, report to the colonel. Bring climbing rope."
Flens took a las rifle from one of the dead, blessed it silently to assuage the soul of its previous owner, and checked the ammo clips. Brockus had two of his platoon gather spare lamp packs from the passing men. The rearguard platoon watched over Flens and his team as they made ready and descended into the shaft under the stones. In the isolation sphere of the command globe, Haldane sensed this maneuver. He hadn't been inside the fool Flens's mind for long enough to turn him, but he had left his mark there, and through that psychic window he could sense and feel so much already. Above all, he could feel Flens's bitter hatred. So, Drevere was trying a ploy of his own, playing his own man Flens into the intrigue, anxious to secure his own leverage. Aching with dull pain, Haldane knew he should be angry with the Lord General. But there was no time, and he hadn't the willpower to spare for such luxuries. He would accommodate Drevere's counterploy and appropriate what elements of it he could use for his own devices. For mankind, for the grand scheme at hand, he would serve and manipulate and win the Vermilion treasure hidden beneath target Primaris. Then, and only then, he would allow himself to die. He swallowed his pain. blanked out the soft embrace of death. The pain was useful in one sense. Just as it allowed him to co-opt the minds of blunt tools, so it gave his own mind focus. He could dwell upon his own deep agony and drive it on like a psychic scalpel to slit open the reserve of his pawn and make him function more ably. He looked at the mirror again, the life support machines around him thumping and wheezing. He saw how his hand trembled and killed the shake with a stab of concentration. He saw into the small mind of his pawn again, sensed the close, cold, airless space of the tunnels he moved through, far beneath the tumbling steatite of the necropolis. He branched out with his thoughts, seeing and feeling his way into the spaces ahead of his pawn. There was warmth there, intellect, pulsing blood, Haldane tensed, and sent a jolt of warning to his pawn. Ambush ahead! 20. They had reached a long, low cistern of rock, pale blue and glassy, which branched off ahead in four directions. Oily black water trickled and pooled down the center of the sloping floor space. Rorn felt himself tense and falter. He reached out a hand to support himself against the gritty wall, as a stabbing pain entered his head and clung like a great arachnid, biting into the bones of his face. His vision doubled, then swirled. It was like a warning him that something ahead was. The Major screeched an inarticulate sound that made the others turn or drop in surprise. The noise had barely begun to echo back down the cistern when Wayland was firing, raking the darkness ahead with his lasgun, bellowing deployment orders. A volley of barbs and lasblasts spat back at them. Gaunt dropped against a slumped rock as gunfire cracked and fizzed against the glassy walls over him. They almost walked into that, if it hadn't been for Rorn's warning and Ferrid's rapid reaction. But how had Rorn known? He was well back in the file. How could he have seen anything that McCull's sharp eyes, right at the front, had missed? Ferrid was calling the shots at the moment, but Gaunt didn't resent the abuse of command. He trusted his friend's tactical instinct, and Ferrid was in a better position and line of sight to direct the tunnel fight. Gaunt clicked off his lamp pack to stop himself becoming a target, and then swung his las rifle up to sight and fire. McCull, Kafran, Baru, and the tactician's troopers were sustaining fire from their own weapons, and Larkin was using his exotic rifle to cover Bragg while he moved the hefty autocannon up into a position to fire. Dorden cowered with Domor. Rorn bellied forward and fitted a barbed round to his stolen weapon. He rose, fingers feeling their way around the unfamiliar trigger grip, and blasted a buzzing barb up the throat of the passage. There was a crump and a scream. Rorn quickly reloaded and fired again, his shot snaking like a slow, heavy bee between the darting light jags of the other men's lasguns. Larkin's rifle fired repeatedly with its curious clap-blast double sound. Then Bragg opened up, shuddering the entire chamber with his heavy, rapid blasts. The close air was suddenly thick with cordite smoke and spent physoline.
"Cease fire! Cease!"
Gaunt yelled with a downward snap of his hand. Silence fell. Heartbeats pounded for 10 seconds. 20. Almost a minute, and then the charge came. The enemy swarmed down into the chamber, flooding out of two of the tunnel forks ahead. Gaunt's men waited, disciplined to know without order how long to pause. Then they opened up again. Rorn's barb gun, Bragg's autocannon, Larkin's carbine, the lasguns of Gaunt, Ferrid, McCull, Baru, Kafran, and the three Crusade bodyguards. The cistern boxed the target for them. In 10 seconds, there were almost 30 dead foe bunched and crumpled in the narrow chamber, their bodies impeding the advance of those behind, making them easier targets. Gaunt knelt in concealment, firing his lasgun over a steatite block with the drilled trackside fire readdress pattern which he had trained into his men. He expected it of them, and knew they expected no less in return. They were slaughtering the enemy, every carefully placed shot exploding through plastic bodysuits and masked visors. But there was no slowing of the tide. Gaunt began to wonder what would run out first, the flow of enemy, his team's ammo, or airspace in the cistern not filled with dead flesh. 21. They emerged from the stifling shadows of the necropolis arches and into a vast interior valley of baking heat and warmth radiating rock. Brockus and his men blinked in the light, eyes watering at the intense heat. The major snapped orders left and right, bringing his men up and thinning the file, extending in a wide front between the jumbled monoliths and splintered boulders. He kept as many of his soldiers in the sweeping overhanging shadows of the valley sides as he could. Ahead, no more than 2 kilometers away, a great combat was taking place. Brockus could see the lasfire flashing over and between the rocky outcrops of the valley basin, and the boiling smoke plumes of a pitched infantry battle were rising up into the pale light above the valley. He could hear laser blasts, the rasp of melters, the occasional fizz of rockets, and knew that Colonel Corbeck's despicable ghosts had engaged ahead. There were other sounds, too. The whir of motors, the buzz of barbs, the chatter of exotic repeater cannons, and bellows and screams of men, a long backwash of noise that ululated up and down the soundbox of the valley. Brockus tapped his microbead link.
A tricky play, my brave boys. We come upon the Tanith from the rear to crush them. But defend against the vermin they are engaging. Kill the ghosts so we get to face the enemy ourselves. Face them and carry back the glory of victory to the ancestral towers of Jant Prime. Normanidus Excelsius!
600 voices answered in a ripple of approval, uttering the syllables of the devotional creed, and the war hymn began spontaneously, echoing like the sonorous swell of an ecclesiarchy litany from the rock faces around and above them, as if from the polished basalt of a great cathedral. Most of the patricians had raised their blast cowls because of the heat, but now they snapped the visors back down in place, covering their faces with the diamond ice-lit visages of war. Their battle hymn moved to the channels of their microbeads, resounding in the ears of every man present. Brockus slid down his own blast cowl so that the hymn swam in his earpiece and around the close, hot metal confines of his battle-dress helmet. He turned to Trooper Farrant at his side and unslung his lasgun. Wordlessly, Farrant exchanged his heavy stubber and ammunition webbing for his commander's rifle. He nodded solemnly at the honor. The commander would carry his heavy weapon into combat at the head of the patricians, the Emperor's chosen. Brockus arranged the heavy webbing around his waist and shoulders with deft assistance from Farrant, settling the weighty pouches with their drum ammo feeders against his back and thighs. Then he braced the huge stubber in his gloved fists, right hand around the trigger grip, the skeleton stock under his right armpit, his left hand holding the lateral brace so that he could sweep the barrel freely. His right thumb hit the switch that cycled the ammo advance. The belt feed chattered fat, ugly cartridges into place, and the water-cooled barrel began to steam and hiss gently. Brockus had advanced to the head of his phalanx when one of his rear guard voxed directly to him.
"Troop units, inbound to our rear!"
Brockus turned. At first he saw nothing. Then he detected faint movement against the milky blue and charred blocks of the archway curtain behind them. Soldiers were coming through in their wake, hundreds of them, almost invisible in the treacherous sidelight of the valley. The body armor they wore was reflective and shimmering.
The Vitrians.
Brockus smiled under his blast cowl and prepared to signal the Vitrian commander.
With the support of the Vitrian dragoons, they could. Lasfire erupted along the rear line of his regiment.
Colonel Zoran led his men directly down onto the exposed and straggling line of the Jantine patricians. They were upwards of 600 in number, and the Vitrians only 400, but he had them on the turn. Gaunt's message had been as per their agreement, though it was still the worst, most devastating message he had received in 16 years as a fighting man. Their mutual enemies had shown their hands, and now the success of the venture depended on his loyalty. To Colonel Commissar Gaunt. To the man called Ferid, among other things. To the Emperor. It went against all his schooling as an Imperial Guardsman, all his nature. It went against the intricate teachings of the Bayhata. But still, the Bayhata said there was honor in friendship, and friendship in valor. Loyalty and honor, the twinned fundamental aspects of the Vitrian art of war. Let Drevere have him shot, him and all 400 of his men. This was not insubordination, nor was it insurrection. Gaunt had shown the colonel what was at stake. He had shown him the greater levels of loyalty and honor at stake on Menazoid Epsilon. He had been truer to the Emperor and truer to the teachings of the Bayhata than Drevere could ever have been. In a triple arrowhead formation, almost invisible in their glass armor, the Vitrian dragoons punched into the hindquarters of Brocas's extended advance line, a tight, dense triple wedge where the patricians were loose and extended. The Jantine had formed a lateral file to embrace the enemy, utterly useless for countering a rearguard sweep. So it said in the Bihata, Book 6, Segment 31, page 406. The patricians had greater strength, but their line was convex, where it should have been concave. Zoran's men tore them apart. Zoran had ordered his men to set las weapons for maximum discharge. He hoped Colonel Commissar Gaunt would forgive the extravagance, but the Jantine heavy troops wore notoriously thick armor. The 1st Regiment of the Jantine Patricians, the so-called Emperor's Chosen, the Imperial Guard Elite, was destroyed that late afternoon in the valley inside the necropolis of the target Primaris. The noble forces of the Vitrian Dragoons 3rd, years later to be decorated and celebrated as one of the foremost guard armies, took on their superior numbers and vanquished them in a pitched battle that lasted 28 minutes, and relied for the most part on tactical discretion. Major Brocas denied the Vitrians for as long as he was able. Screaming in outrage and despair, he smashed back through his own ranks to confront the Vitrians with Farrant's massive autocannon. It was in no way the death he had foreseen for himself, nor the death of his celebrated company. He bellowed at his men, admonishing them for dying, kicking at corpses as they fell around him in a raging despair to get them to stand up again. In the end, Brocas was overwhelmed by a stinging wash of anger that, having come so far, fought so hard, he and his patricians would be cheated. Cheated of everything they deserved. Cheated of glory by this inglorious end. Cheated of life by lesser, weaker men who nevertheless had the resolve to fight courageously for what they believed in. He was amongst the last to die. As the last few shells clattered out of his ammo drums, raining into the Vitrian advance as he squeezed the trigger of the smoking, hissing stubber on full rapid. Brocas personally killed 44 Vitrian dragoons in the course of the Jantine First's last stand. His autocannon was close to overheating when he was killed by a Vitrian sergeant called Zogat. His armored torso pulverized by Zogat's marksmanship, Brocas toppled into the flecked mica sand of the valley floor, and his name, bearing, manner, and being was utterly extinguished from the imperial record. 22. Then Baru died. The filthy barbed round smelted into the rock face behind him and ribboned him with its lethal backwash of shrapnel. He didn't even have time to scream. From his cover, seeing the death and regretting it desperately, Gaunt slid around and set his lasgun to full auto, bombarding the torrent of foe with a vivid cascade of phosphorescent bolts. He heard Rawn scream something unintelligible. Baru, one of his finest, as good a scout and stealther as McColl, pride of the Tanith. Pulling back into cover to exchange ammo clips, Gaunt glanced back at the wet ruin that had been his favored scout. Claws of misery dug into him. For the first time since Ked, the Commissar tasted the acrid futility of war. A soldier dies, and it is the responsibility of his commander to rise above the loss and focus. But Baru, sharp, witty Baru, a favorite of the men, the clown and joker, the invisible stealther, the truest of true. Gaunt found he could not look at the corpse, at the torn mess that had once been a man he called friend, and whom he trusted beyond simple trust. Around him, and he was oblivious to it, the other guard soldiers blasted into the ranks of the enemy. Abruptly, as if turned off like a tap, the flow of charging cultists faltered and stopped. Larkin continued to pop away with his long-snouted carbine, and Rawn sent round after round of barb heads into the dark. Then silence, darkness, except for the fizzle of ignited clothing and the seep of blood. Ferid's voice lifted over them, urgent and strong.
They're done! Advance!
He's too eager, thought Gaunt. Too eager. And I'm the commander here. He rose from cover, seeing the other troopers scrambling up to follow Ferid.
Hold!
He barked. They all turned to face him, Ferid blinking in confusion.
We do this my way or not at all, Gaunt said sternly, crossing to Baru's remains.
He knelt over them, plucking the Tanith silver icon up and over his shirt collar, dangling it on the neck chain. In low words, echoed by Dorden, Larkin, and McColl, he pronounced the funeral rites of the Tanith, one of the first things Milo had taught him. Rorn, Bragg, and Caffran lowered their heads. Domor slumped in uneasy silence. Gorn stood from the corpse and tucked the chain-hooked charm away. He looked at Ferrid. The Imperial tactician had marshalled his men in a solemn honour guard, heads steepled low, behind the Tanith.
"A good man, Bram. A true loss,"
Ferrid said with import.
"You'll never know," Gorn said, snatching up his lasgun in a sudden turn and advancing into the thicket of enemy dead.
He turned.
"McColl, with me. We'll advance together."
McColl hustled up to join him.
"Ferrid, have your men watch our backs," Gorn said.
Ferrid nodded his agreement and pulled his troopers back into the van of the advance. Now it went Gaunt and McColl, Bragg, Rorn and Larkin, Dorden with Domor, Caffran, Ferrid, and his bodyguard. They trod carefully over and between the fallen bodies of the foe and found the tunnel dipped steeply into a wider place. Light, like it was being emitted from the belly of a glowing insect, shone from the gloom ahead, outlining an arched doorway. They advanced, weapons ready, until they stood in its shadows.
"We're there,"
McColl said, with finality. Gaunt slipped his data slate out of his pocket and thought to consult his portable geocompass, but McColl's instinct was far more reliable than the little purring dial. The commissar looked at the slate, winding the decoded information across the little plate with a touch of the thumb wheel.
"The map calls this the Edicule, a shrine, a resting place. It's the focus of the entire necropolis. And it's where we'll find this thing?"
McColl asked darkly. Gaunt nodded and took a step into the lit archway. Beyond the crumbling black granite of the arch, a great vault stretched away. Floor, walls, and roof all fashioned from opalescent stone, lit up by some unearthly green glow. Gaunt blinked, accustoming his eyes to the lambent sheen. McColl edged in behind him, then Rorn. Gaunt noticed how their breaths were steaming in the air. It was many degrees colder in the vault, the atmosphere damp and heavy. Gaunt clicked off his now redundant lamp pack.
"It looks empty," Major Rorn said, looking about them.
They all heard how small and muffled his voice sounded, distorted by the strange atmospherics of the room. Gaunt gestured at the far end wall, 60 meters away, where the thin scribing of a doorway was marked on the stone wall. A great rectangular door, or doors, maybe 15 meters high, set flush into the wall itself.
"This is the outer approach chamber. The edicule itself is beyond those doors."
Rorn took a pace forward, but pulled up in surprise as Sergeant McColl placed an arresting hand on his arm.
"Not so fast, eh?" McColl nodded at the floor ahead of them. "These vaults have been teeming with the enemy, but the dust on that floor hasn't been disturbed for decades at least. And you see the patterning in the dust."
Both Rorn and Gaunt stooped their heads to get an angle to see what McColl described. Catching the light right, they could see almost invisible spirals and circles in the thick dust, like droplet ripples frozen in ash.
"Your data said something about wards and prohibitions on the entrance to the edicule. This area hasn't been traversed in a long while, and I'd guess those patterns are imprints in the dust made by energies or force screens. Like a storm shield, maybe. We know the enemy here has some serious crap at their disposal."
Gaunt scratched his cheek, thinking. McColl was right, and had been sharp-witted to remember the data notes at a moment where Gaunt was all for rushing ahead, so close was the prize. Somehow, Gaunt had expected gun emplacements, chain fences, wire strands, conventional wards and prohibitions. He caught Rorn's eye and saw the resentment burning there. Gaunt had still managed to exclude the Major from the details he had shared with the other officers, and Rorn remained in the dark as to the nature of this insertion, if not its importance. Gaunt had only brought him along because of his ruthless expertise in tunnel fighting. Because, after the business on the Absalom, he wanted to keep Rorn where he could see him. And, of course, there was... Gaunt blinked off the thoughts.
"Get me Domor's sweeper set. I'll sweep the room myself."
"I'll do it, sir,"
a voice said from behind them. The others had edged into the chamber behind them, with Ferrid's men watching the arch, though even they were clearly more interested in what lay ahead. Domor himself had spoken.
He was standing by himself now, a little shaky but upright. Dorden's high-dose painkillers had given him a brief respite from pain and a temporary renewal of strength.
"It should be me," Gorn said softly, and Domo angled his blind face slightly to direct himself at the sound of the voice.
"Oh, no, sir. Begging your pardon."
Domo smiled below the swathe of eye bandage. He tapped the sweeper set slung from his shoulder.
"You know I'm the best sweeper in the unit, and it's all a matter of listening to the pulse in the headset. I don't need to see. This is my job."
There was a long silence in which the dense air of the ancient vault seemed to buzz in their ears. Gaunt knew Domo was right about his skills, and moreover, he knew what Domo was really saying. "I'm a ghost, sir. Expendable." Gaunt made his decision, not based on any notion of expendability. Here was a task Domo could do better than any of them. And if Gaunt could still make the man feel a useful part of the team, he would not crush the pride of a soldier already dying.
"Do it. Maximum coverage. Maximum caution. I'll guide you by voice and we'll string a line to you so he can pull you back."
The look on what was left of Domo's face was worth more than anything they could find beyond those doors, Gaunt thought. Kafran stepped forward to attach a rope to Domo as McColl checked the test settings on the sweeper set and adjusted the headphones around Domo's ears.
"Gaunt, you're joking,"
Ferrid snapped, pushing forward. His voice dropped to a hiss.
"Are you seriously going to waste time with this charade? This is the most important thing any of us are ever going to do. Let one of my men do the sweep. Hell, I'll do the sweep."
"Domo is sweeper, officer. He'll do it."
"But
he'll do it, Ferrid."
Domo began his crossing, moving in a straight line across the ancient floor, one step at a time. He stopped after each footfall to retune the clicking, pulsing sweeper, listening with experience-attuned ears to every hiss and murmur of the set. Kafran played out the line behind him. After a few yards, he edged to the right. Then, a little further on, jinked left again. His erratic path was perfectly recorded in the dust.
"There are cones of energy radiating from the floor at irregular intervals,"
Domo whispered over the micro-bead intercom.
"Who knows what and for why, but I'm betting it wouldn't be a good idea to interrupt one."
Time wound on, achingly slow. Domo slowly, indirectly, approached the far side of the chamber.
"Gaunt, the line, the Fethin line,"
Dorden said abruptly, pointing. Gaunt immediately saw what the doctor was referring to. Domo was safely negotiating the invisible obstacles, but his safety line was trailing behind him in a far more economical course between the sweeper and his team. Any moment, and its dragging weight might intersect with an unseen energy cone.
"Domo, freeze!" Gaunt snarled into the intercom.
On the far side of the vault, Domo stopped dead.
"Untie your safety line and let it drop," the commissar instructed him.
Wordless, Domo complied, fumbling blindly to undo the slipknot Kafran had tied. It would not come free. Domo tried to gather some slack from the line to ease the knot, and in jiggling it, shook the strap of the sweeper set off his shoulder. The rope came free and dropped, but the heavy sweeper slipped down his arm, and his arm spasmed to hook it on his elbow. Domo caught the set, but the motion had pulled on the cord of his headset and plucked it off. The headset clattered onto the dusty floor about a meter from his feet. Everyone on Gaunt's side of the chamber flinched, but nothing happened. Domo struggled with the set for a moment and returned it to his shoulder.
"The headset, where did it go?"
he asked over the microbead.
"Don't move. Stay still."
Gaunt threw his lasgun to Rawn, and as quickly as he dared, followed Domo's route in the dust across the chamber. He came up behind the frozen blind man, spoke low and reassuringly so as not to make Domo turn suddenly, then reached past him, crouching low, to scoop up the headset. He plugged the jack back into its socket and placed the earpieces back around Domo's head.
"Let's finish this," Gaunt said.
They moved on, close together, Gaunt letting Domo set the pace and direction. It took another 4 minutes to reach the doorway. Gaunt signaled back at his team and instructed them to follow the pair of them over on the path Domo had made. He noticed that Ferrid was first in line, his face set with an urgent, impatient scowl. As they came, Gaunt turned his attention back to the door. It was visible only by its seams in the rock, a marvelously smooth piece of precision engineering. Gaunt did what the data crystal had told him he should.
He placed an open palm against the right-hand edge of the door and exerted gentle pressure. Silently, the twin 15-meter-tall blocks of stone rolled back and opened. Beyond lay a huge chamber so brightly lit and gleaming it made Gaunt close his eyes and wince.
What do you see?
Domor asked by his side.
I don't know, Gaunt said, blinking, but it's the most incredible thing I've ever seen.
The others closed in behind them, looking up in astonishment, crossing the threshold of the edicule behind Gaunt and the eager Ferid. Rorn was the last inside. 23. Inquisitor Haldane allowed himself a gentle shudder of relief. His pawn was now inside the sacred edicule of the Menazoid necropolis, and with him went Haldane's senses and intellect. After all this time, all this effort, he was right there, channeled through blunt mortal instruments until his mind was engaging first-hand with the most precious artifact in space. The most precious, the most dangerous, the most limitless of possibilities. A means, at last, with all confidence, to overthrow Makarov and the stagnating imperial rule he espoused. It would make Dravir Warmaster, and Dravir would in turn be his instrument. All the while mankind fought the dark with light, he was doomed to eventual defeat. The Grey, thought Haldane. The secret weapons of the Grey. Those things that the hardliners of the Imperium were too afraid to use, the devices and possibilities that lay in the blurred moral fogs beyond the simple and the just. That is how he would lead mankind out of the dark and into true ascendancy, crushing the perverse alien menaces of the galaxy and all those loyal to the old ways alike. Of course, if Dravir used this weapon and seized control of the Crusade, used it to push the campaign on to undreamed-of victory, then the High Lords of Terra would be bound to castigate him and declare him treasonous. But they wouldn't know until it was done. And then, in the light of those victories, how could they gainsay his decision? Some of the orderlies in the Isolation Bay began to notice the irregularities registering in the Inquisitor's biomonitors and started forward to investigate. He sent them scurrying out of sight with a lash of his psyche. Haldane took up the hand mirror again and gazed into it until his mind loosed once more and he was able to psychically dive into its reflective skin like a swimmer into a still pool. Invisible, he surfaced amongst Gaunt's wandering team in the edicule. He turned the eyes of his pawn to take it all in. A cylindrical chamber 1,000 meters high and 500 in diameter. The walls fibrous and knotted with pipes and flutes and tubes of silver and chromium. Brilliant white light shafted down from far above. The floor underfoot was chased with silver, richly inscribed with impossibly complex algorithmic paradoxes, 1,000 to a square meter. Haldane expanded his mind in a heartbeat and read them all, solved them all. Bounding eagerly beyond this trifle, he looked around and focused on the great structure which dominated the center of the chamber. A machine. A vast device made of brilliant white ceramics, silver piping, chromium chambers. A standard template constructor. Intact. The secrets of originating technology had been lost to mankind for so long. Since the Dark Ages, the Imperium, even the Adeptus Mechanicus could only manufacture things they had learned by recovering the processes of the ancient STC systems. From scraps and remnants of shattered STC systems on 1,000 dead worlds, the Imperium had slowly relearned the secrets of construction, of tanks and machines and laser weapons. Every last fragment was priceless. To find a dedicated constructor intact was a find made once a generation, a find from which the entire Imperium benefited. But to find one like this intact was surely without precedent. All of the speculation had been correct. Long ago, thousands of years before chaos had overwhelmed it, Menazoid Epsilon had been an arsenal world, manufacturing the ultimate weapon known to those lost ages.
The secrets of its process and purpose were contained within those 1.5 million algorithms etched into the wide floor. The Men of Iron. A rumor so old it was a myth. A myth from the oldest times, before the age of strife, from the dark age of technology, when mankind had reached a state of glory as the masters of a techno-automatic empire, the race that had perfected the standard template construct. They created the Men of Iron, mechanical beings of power and sentience, but no human soul. Heretical devices in the eyes of the Imperium. War with the self-aware Men of Iron had led to the fall of that distant empire, and, if the old, deeply arcane records Haldane had been privy to were correct, that was why the Imperium had outlawed any soulless mechanical intelligence. But, as servants, implacable warriors, what could not be achieved with Men of Iron at your side? Here, at the untouched heart of the ancient arsenal world, was the STC system to make such Men of Iron. There was more. Haldane broadened his focus and took in the walls of the chamber for the first time. At floor level, all around, were alcoves screened by metal grills. Behind them, as still and silent as terracotta statues guarding a royal tomb, stood phalanxes of Men of Iron. Hundreds, hundreds of hundreds, ranked back in symmetrical rows into the shadows of the alcove. Each stood far taller than a man, with faces like sightless skulls of burnished steel, the sinews and arteries of their bodies formed from cable and wire, encased in anatomical plate sections of lusterless alloy. They slept, waiting the command to awaken, waiting to receive orders, waiting to ignite the great device once more and multiply their forces again. Haldane breathed hard to quell his excitement. He wound his senses back into his pawn and surveyed the gathered men. Gaunt gazed in solemn wonder. The ghosts were transfixed with awe and bafflement, the crusade staff alert and eager to investigate. Gaunt turned to Dorden and ordered him to take Domor aside and let him rest. He told the other ghosts to stand down and relax. Then he crossed to Ferid, who was standing before the vast STC device, his helmet dangling by its chin-strap from his hand.
"The prize, old friend," Ferid said, without turning.
"The prize. I hope it was worth it." Now Ferid turned to look.
"Do you have any idea what this is?"
"Ever since I unlocked that crystal, you know that I have. I don't pretend to understand the technology, but I know that's an intact standard template weapons maker. And I know that's as unheard of as a well-manicured orc." Ferid laughed.
60 years ago, on Galus Auspex, a rat-water world a long way from nothing, in Plago Sutanus, a team of Imperial scouts found an intact STC in the ruins of a pyramid city in a jungle basin. Intact. You know what it made? It was the standard template constructor for a type of steel blade, an alloy of folded steel composite that was sharper and lighter and tougher than anything we've had before. 30 whole chapters of the Great Astartes are now using blades of the new pattern. The scouts became heroes. I believe each was given a world of his own. It was regarded as the greatest technological advance of the century, the greatest discovery, the most perfect and valuable STC recovery in living memory. That made knives, Bram. Knives, daggers, bayonets, swords. It made blades, and it was the greatest discovery in memory. Compared to this, it's less than nothing. Take one of those wonderful new blades and face me with the weapon this thing can make.
I read the crystal before you did, Ferid. I know what it can do. Men of Iron, the old myth, one of the tales of the great old wars. Ferid grinned.
Then breathe in this moment, my friend. We've found the impossible here, a device to guarantee the ascendancy of man. What's a stronger, lighter, sharper, better blade when you can overrun the homeworld of the man wielding it with a legion of deathless warriors? This is history, you know, alive in the air around us. This makes us the greatest of men. Don't you feel it?
Gaunt and Ferrid both turned slowly, surveying the silent ranks of metal beings waiting behind the grills. Gaunt hesitated.
I feel only horror. To have fought and killed and sacrificed just to win a device that will do more of the same a thousandfold. This isn't a prize, Ferrid.